Okay, so I'm going to shorten the share because it's the hour. And what I want to do is just read, all this is based on the Ma'arik. Okay, everyone agrees that all this is based on the Ma'arik. So what I want to do is read the Ma'arik with you, and then you decide whether the Ma'arik says this or not. Okay, you have to know something. Couple of things, first of all. Firstly, you have to know that in Shulchan Aruch, Ma'arik is cited as Siman Kuf Ayin Bet, which is what it must have been in that edition, but in our editions, the Ma'arik is Kuf Ayin Aleph, so if you look it up in Bar Ilan later, look up Kuf Ayin Bet, it's not there, it's not there. The second thing you have to know is that the Ma'arik actually wrote two Tshuvot on this topic, which we have as Kuf Ayin and Kuf Ayin Aleph, even though the Shulchan Aruch only quotes the second of them, and the Shach only quotes the second of them here, and that may matter. But what I'm going to do right now is I'm just going to read the Tshuva of the Ma'arik with you, and you just keep in mind, right, that we have to figure out what the word Minhag means. And particularly, right, we're trying to figure out what the Ramah meant when he quoted the Ma'arik as saying, Kol Devar Shetaluy B'Minhag B'nei Ha'ir, because the Shach said, that means the same kind of Minhag as by women shechting. So is that true? Is the Minhag the Ma'arik is talking about the same as the Minhag by women shechting? So here we go. Ma'arik says the following. Alechem Ishim HaRashim Achinu Kal Kodesh Yoshvei Fiorentz. I think that's Ferenc, right? We say Ferenc now. Shalom Rav. I got your letter through your right through your shliach on the right on Motzoi Shavuos, and really, right? I'm really really very very busy. But because I love you, I turned aside from all my businesses just to listen to you. But you should know that you're not the first ones who asked this question. Other people have asked me this question. So here we go. Line 5. Vani dachiti mechavodei, right, so I avoided expressing my opinion. Adashir chakarti v'derashti heitev v'shevach hikirot v'drishot, until I did really impressive due diligence. Ladat, in order to know, tochen haminhag hazeh, the content of this custom, asher nagu haloazim, which these foreigners have, l'shager tamid doron l'kala me'et achatan, Tekef acharasiyat hakinyan, to give a gift to the bride immediately after the asiyat hakinyan. So you have to be very careful here, because asiyat hakinyan here does not mean kinyan kedushin. Asiyat hakinyan here means tnoim. Okay, so the custom of these foreigners was that whenever the families agreed on the shidduch, they would immediately send a gift to the bride. Okay, what happens often, unfortunately, is that then the engagement breaks up. And that raises two sorts of questions. One is, does the bride have to give the stuff back? And two is, can the bride now get remarried without a get? Because there's a Gemara which debates the question. Under such circumstances, depending which Rishon you take, either do we say that the fact that the gifts were sent is evidence that they must have been married already, because nobody would risk giving these kind of valuable things to the bride if she could just break the engagement and walk away. So they must have been married first. Or secondly, maybe every time people send gifts to a bride, we're worried that those gifts are for the sake of marriage. Okay, when my wife and I were going out, we were very makpit to say shlo l'shem kiddushin. When we gave gifts to be choshesh. For such position, but it's risky, of course. If you ever forget once, then you write stuff. I don't recommend this as a okay. But here's what the Ma'arik says. He says ki amarti elibi, right? So he's trying to find out what this minhag is. Shari ki amarti elibi shei efshar shiyoru asivlot lenot aila inyan kiddushin. I said to myself, this is Ma'arik speaking, it's impossible that these gifts, these Sivlanot is the name for these gifts, it's impossible that these gifts are intended to indicate that marriage has taken place. Why? Shere yadanu v'gam sipru lanu avotenu rishonim asher yu lefeinu, right? Because our ancestors have told us, hayu arbe tov seitera b'gulot italia v'chazim anchei masa. There were lots of really serious people in the right, in this wild, the wilds of Italy, right, in the plains of Italy, whatever. Asher mistama shegam heim nagu minagzeh. And they presumably had this custom that the Italians have. V'im haya bazeh chashash kiddushin. And if there was a risk of marriage, right, there's a risk of marriage in if you gave gifts to the bride immediately after agreeing to tnaim, in yadam, then they would have created this massive thing because there are all these women who might go off and get married out of get. So therefore it must be, if serious people had the custom of giving gifts to the bride immediately after tnaim, it must be that has no intention for kedushin. Okay. The chalila v'chas lahotzi lazal rishonim, and God forbid that we should suggest that the rishonim engaged in a practice which could lead to adultery, because they're so much greater than we are. And not only that, there are still smart people there, and the Yerushalmi says, if you don't know what the halacha is, go see what the community says. Here we get to the bold part. Vinei, galuya mefur samhu, it is perfectly well known, ki kulam noagim minhagze, every single one of them has this custom. V'ish behem lo ne'edar, and not a single one of them does not have this custom. What custom? Of giving gifts to the bride after the time. Upamim rabot chozrim behem omete chatan kodem zman achupa, right? And many times they go back on the engagement, or the chatan dies before the chupa. But what I hear from all the learned people in that area is shelorau shum putze pe umitzafzef latzricha chalikza kishemet oget kishemet chartin. I have never, right, they all tell me that that nobody has ever objected to such a woman remarrying without a get or a chalitza. Okay. So let's talk about what Marik says. What Marik says is that you have a place where he says the custom, beyond question, the custom is that they give gifts to the bride immediately after the time. Is that a halachic custom? Does anyone think you have to do it? No, it's the practical custom. Okay? And then he says that it often happens that the engagement is then broken and the women get remarried without requiring a get, and I have never seen anybody object to this. So what is it that we haven't seen? We haven't seen an objection, which really means we have seen this done many times. It often happens that women break their engagements and they get remarried, and we've never seen an objection. So this is not a nihug b'shev altase. It is unrelated to a passive custom. Right? It's a report of an active thing that people, right? Rabbis are and people are perfectly happy to marry women. The only silence is that nobody objects. The only minhag that is being established is the question of what people's practices are in terms of the giving of gifts to brides. No halachic significance, whatever. Yes, yes. That people didn't what? Yeah, they get married. Not they don't give a get, they get married.
Right, or they get married to someone else, right?
They get married to somebody else, yes, which is H is Ish.
So lower in that people have given a get, in the Raya, that is not about giving a get.
How do you frame it as negatively, I haven't seen somebody give a get, as opposed to positively, I have seen, what could be more positive than, I have seen people get married. That's positive. That's not lower Inu, that's Reinu. That's always true, right? I mean, come on, right? I've seen people eat that. Well, I haven't seen people not eat it. It's as positive a thing as you can imagine to say that, right? To say that I have seen, right? What greater evidence of positive halachic evidence is there than the claim that I saw somebody be Masadir Kedushin for that woman? Yeah. That's right, but it's not that I haven't seen them give a get, right? It's that this woman is free, and I haven't seen them give. There's no minhag here, right? The question. This is the most serious issue of halacha you have is eish et ish, right? The shach claims that you can prove from here that there's a special rule that even though in the area of halakha, you can't use lo re'inu as a raya, but in the realm of minhag, you can use lo re'inu as a raya. This is not minhag. This is esh es ish. This is hilchos deraisa skila. Right? There's no conceivable connection, I think. There was a hand here. Yes. So you're going back a few steps, right? Because we just got rid of that, right?
Yeah.
Yesh said that, right? Nobody ever held that. Right? We can tell what Tanis Dibur is, but I walk up to you and I say, "Hi, how are you doing?" And you say, "Mmm." Right? So that's not Lorainu, right? That's
all right. Talking Messiah around your neck saying, "I am doing a Tanis."
You're right. That's all sorts of ways, right, to establish a custom. I don't understand what the question was. Yes.
Flip side. What constitutes a kosher pattern topic? Because if the Ma'arik's been asked this, Barnish Alpi Alfayot about the Yomim Avim, apparently this is not the first kosher pattern topic.
Okay. So the beauty of this tshuva is, right, obviously, if you have to write the tshuva, right, obviously somebody is making this objection. Yeah, so the answer is, but these are new people, because they moved from somewhere else.
Eyes of the low, I think.
Right, yes. Right, no, there's the minhag of the loazim, and then other people have come into this place who don't know what the minhag of the loazim are, and they say, look at these loazim, right, aren't they marrying eshazish? And Marik says to them, no, they're not marrying eshazish, right? Right, nobody's ever objected. Obviously, it was not intended as kedushin. You're claiming it was intended as kedushin. It's not intended as kedushin at all. Okay. Then, just so you understand, how beautiful and powerful a tshuva this is. So the next bold section is. So the hinei haglilos halalu lefi ma she'idu lefanai miksinei haaretz v'toshaveha kulan. So I mean v'toshaveha. In these places, according to the testimony that I have received from the heads of that land. Everybody gives these gifts and then does kedushin, so you never have to worry the gift means kedushin. Except that, no, sometimes people do kedushin before they give the gifts. Right? And even if it sometimes happens that in fact the guy does marry the woman before he gives her the siblonot, birato pentach zorba, right, because he's afraid she's going to go back. That doesn't break the custom. That's just because he's afraid that somebody else is going to jump in and marry her first. That has nothing to do with the question of siblonot. So Marik gets rid of the exceptions. He knows there are exceptions. He gets rid of them anyway. So they don't change the custom. The custom is that you first, right, is that you give siblonot and then you marry her. And the other cases are just weird exceptions which don't matter to us conceptually at all. Right. That's. You look at his line, he says, Lefia nir laniyas dati, mishum kach lo yichasheva isha zeh miotan shemekadshim v'hadar misablin. Even though this person, in fact, married her and then gave her the gifts, he is not considered in the class of people who marry and then give gifts. Because his motive is different. He's doing it to prevent her from marrying somebody else, not because he's worried about her keeping the gifts. Okay, understand that Marik is trying to prevent massive mamzerut. Right, basically what's happening here is, some people are coming in and claiming that this community, which has had its practices for hundreds of years, probably they're all Amzerim. Because they're all, right, probably some broken engagements. Marik says, no, that's not true. Right, we can establish what their custom is, absolutely, and even if they're exceptions, those exceptions don't mean anything. Okay, now we get to the text, the Shach quote. It says, V'raya mehad degaras v'perek shenem miksubot, and he quotes our Gemara. But what really goes on in our Gemara? He says, here's the case. Two people claim they saw the woman get married. Two people say that she didn't get married. The Gemara says, obviously, they didn't see her get married, so what? Lo re'inu in Uriah. So the Gemara says, no, I still have to tell you don't believe them. Why? Because I might think that if they lived in the same people, nobody gets married secretly. Therefore, a statement of lo re'inu in the, right, together with a presumption that I would know about the marriage would be enough? And the answer is no, but you know what? Some people do get married secretly, and therefore the presumption isn't enough, and you can't believe the two witnesses who say she hasn't gotten married. And the Marie comes along and says, but in our case, no big deal. In our case, since they had the time in public, they probably would have the wedding in public also, so we don't have to worry about, we don't have to worry about that. But what I want to get is that there is not a hint anywhere in the Marie of anything related to halachic minag. There are two issues in the Ma'arik. What is the practical minag about when people give gifts and they marry? And then there's the question, what's the halacha, given those facts as to whether the woman requires a get or not? So the notion that you can build out of this Ma'arik a position that says that in the realm of minhag, we treat lo ra'inu as raya is unrelated to the context of the Ma'arik. If you read the next tshuva of the Ma'arik, which again I think we're getting late, you'll see that nothing changes. But I think what you'll see is that you could understand how somebody could misunderstand the Ma'arik if you only read the second tshuva and not the first, and you didn't know what the context was. But once you've read the first tshuva and you know what the context is, there's no conceivable relationship to minhag. Nobody ever suggests here that there's anything anybody has to do because of minhag. The only questions are, what do people do? And granted that this is what people do, what are the halachic din ish is ish implications of this for the matter of minhag? So now, we go back to what the Ramah says in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah says, when do we say l'ra'ina in uraya? He doesn't say b'minhag amrinan l'ra'ina uraya. He says, kol devar hatalui b'minhag b'nei ha'ir. Everything halachic which depends on popular practice. In such areas we can say l'ra'ina uraya. So l'ra'ina uraya is not, right, it's not a halachic significance at all. What he says is, whenever what the real halakha is, HSH, marriage, what the real halakha is depends on what the popular custom is. So in such cases, if some people say the custom was X and some people say the custom was Y, so then we believe the people, right? So some people say the custom was X and some people say we've never seen it. So we say, okay, you've never seen it. They saw it. But he says, if just like in the case of the Gemara about two people who saw, right, two people say they saw you get married and two people say they saw you didn't get married, if there's no contradictory evidence, right, if we just want to, I want to know is, what is the custom in this town? And people get up and say, what is the practice in this town? And two people get up and say, I've never seen anybody do this. Okay, let's say, case where we'll deal with, you know, a case that came up for me over the summer. Somebody comes up and says, right, a woman wanted to know, could she say, Kel Male from the Abima at Mincha. So the question is, not a question of whether there's a minhag to Asr or not, but it's important to know whether this is the thing that's ever happened in the community or not in terms of establishing what the consequences for a community are. So you turn to someone and you say, has anybody ever seen a woman say, Kel Male from the Abima at Mincha? And the answer is no. So we believe that. Right? If nobody ever says they've seen a woman say Kel Male from the Bima, and a couple of people say we've never seen it, so then we presume that it's never happened. And then any halakha that depends on whether it's happened or not, we will trust the claim that it's never happened. Whether that halakha is halakha on the level of minhag, or whether that halakha is on the level of, right, of eish esish. Okay, all we're saying is, all the Ma'arik stands for is the proposition that if we're trying to find out what a communal custom is, communal practice, I can't use the word. We're trying to find out what people in fact do. So then a claim that we've never seen this happen, which is not opposed by anybody who says, yes, I have seen this happen, is legitimate to establish the facts on which the halakha will afterwards be based. And that's what the, right, that's what the Ramah is quoting it in regard to, right? Kol devar talui b'minhag b'nei ha'ir. All halachic issues that depend on what the practice of the city is. In such areas, we don't require formal standards of evidence. We have common sense standards of evidence. So we believe four witnesses against two, and we believe people who say it's never happened. Okay, so wrap up the halacha. There are, right, you have a Mishnah in Zvachim that says, Lo ra'inu ein raya. Right, that normally negative evidence doesn't prove anything. The Shach makes the claim that this is not, that we can make a distinction between Isur and Minhag. In Isur we say Lo Ra'inu in Araya, but in Minhag we say that Lo Ra'inu is Araya. My argument, which is not obviously my original argument, many other people have made it before me, I'm just presenting, just usually they don't do it inside of the Ma'arik, the only thing I'm doing is showing you what the Ma'arik is actually about. And that's even in the Tumim already also. Right, but I'm just, right, the argument is that you cannot sustain this, right, you cannot sustain the Shach's claim in the Maharik, because the Maharik never addresses the halachic question of Minhag. Kal v'chomer, you can't make a much broader claim that, right, on the Maharik, that the fact that something has never been done is evidence that it can't be done, because Maharik never talks about what can or can't be done. Maharik's only interested in whether this woman is free to remarry or not. None of this means that there isn't, that there can't be such a position about Minhag anyway. It could be that you could just take the Ogur and say the Ogur says that the fact that women can't sheft means, right, haven't shefted means they can't sheft, and you could build that position off the Ogur. Right, you just can't build it off the Maharik. And you can't claim that the Rama holds that broader position. You don't really have any evidence, because I say the simple explanation of the Maharik, the simple explanation of the Rama and the Ogur is that in fact the woman tried and was told no. And then there's no machloket at all. Okay, but I want to say after all this, right, what astonishes me is that while none of the standard evidence cited for this is relevant at all, there is in fact an explicit Gemara which says what they want, which says something like along the lines of what they want to say. And I'm utterly astonished that people don't quote the Gemara which does say this. So if you look at the last source, so the last source is a Gemara Msachim. Gemara Msachim says, Dvarim Hamutarim, things which are permitted l'halacha, v'acherim nahagu bahen isur, but other people have adopted the custom of treating them as forbidden. Iyatara shaylat iran bifnehen. You're not allowed to act as if they are permitted in front of those people who believe it to be forbidden. Okay, now you think they're mistaken. Okay, right, but you know the halakha is this is mutter, but they have practiced as if it was forbidden. Okay. So we have this. Right, so we have a series of stories in a brayta, right? Let's say right, that the brayta halacha is that two brothers are allowed to shower together. So there's a story that Yehuda and Hillel, the sons of Rabbi Gamliel, took a shower together, and everybody started spreading rumors about them. And they said, "What did they say? We've never seen anybody do anything like this."
They were in
So they stopped. Right. So they stopped. Because you're not allowed to do things that other people think are forbidden. Why do they think it's forbidden? Because they've adopted the practice of treating it as forbidden. We have a whole series of cases like this. Now there are some qualifiers here. The Gemara says that's only among people who aren't learned. People who are learned, you tell them, no, you're wrong, that's not the halacha. But people who are not learned, you're right, if they really think it's forbidden, you're not supposed to practice. So there is a Gemara, and the Gemara says, why? Because the fact that people will say, we have never seen this, will, right, that causes them to mistakenly believe it's forbidden. And there are times when you have to give in to their mistaken belief that it's forbidden. That, I believe, is a Gemara which establishes that there are certain circumstances under which the fact that something has not been done, if it's not been done among an unlearned class, so then you have to give in to them and you have to pretend that it's forbidden also. So there are lots of issues related to gender where you could do, but you're right, but I don't want to, it happens that this shows up by Nashim Shochetot, so it easily transfers to issues of gender, but it can relate to, right, it can relate to lots of things. We've never seen anybody, you know, anybody dance with two Sefer Torah at the same time, whatever minhag you want, right? There are lots of things we can, and there are things, probably the most radical thing is there are certain things relating to electricity, right? Let's suppose that you really believe it's perfectly mutter to move electrical appliances on Shabbat. Because it's not a klisha malachto liyisur, right? You look at your clock radio. You're looking at a clock. It's not a klisha malachto liyisur, but most people, right? If you look, right, say you can't move that. It's muksa. So if you're in an audience which you can't explain, no, it's right. Why is it different than the watch on my hand? Right. So in front of such people, you're not allowed to do it because they don't move it, so you can't do it either. But right. So there might be other ways you can construct it. It just flips me out that nobody quotes this Gemara, but the. But what I hope really is a very, very simple argument tonight, right, is that the only two sources that anybody cites on this issue, one is the Ogur, and one is the Maharik. The Maharik is, I think, unquestionably irrelevant, and the Ogur can be explained in many other ways, such that I think that nobody ever really tried to build a position just on the Ogur itself. So I don't think that there is a, I don't think that the argument in such terms that it's never been done, therefore there is a minhag that forbids it from being done, I'm not aware of a good argument for that position. Okay, that's really the, Josh, you had a question?
I thought the Gemara in Kulin where Rashi was not here, Beit Shan.
Yeah.
Rebbe.
Right. So you have, yeah, so you have other places. You have lots of places where people change the halacha, right? Yeah, I don't think. But again, so for me, the purpose of this shiur, and I hope that all of you get it clear, is really and evaluate just on that basis. Is there a viable principle which says that the fact that something hasn't been done is either A, the reason it can't be done, or B, evidence that there must be some underlying custom not to have it be done? So the answer is, I think not. Because the only source anybody uses seriously is the Ma'arik, and the Ma'arik has nothing to do with Minhag. Yes, Yaakov.
Isn't the Agur still a good pretext? Because obviously the Beis Yosef understood him to be saying, lo renew, is a riot. Because if the Beis Yosef knew that the Agur saw somebody try and get cut down, then the Beis Yosef wouldn't be arguing.
Okay, good. So this is a great methodological question. Beis Yosef quotes the Agur and rejects him because he says that makes no sense. So we can say, aha, the Beis Yosef correctly understood the Agur and we will paskin like him against the Beis Yosef, or we can say, no, the Beis Yosef is right, that makes no sense, he must have misunderstood the Agur. Again, there are two reasons. Beis Yosef said, the Agur said this, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
We can say, but the Beis Yosef understood the Agur that way, we're going to reject the Beis Yosef and support the Agur. Or we can say, no, the reason the Beis Yosef rejected the Agur is because he understood him that way. We think that actually the Agur makes sense.
Yeah.
No, we could say that the Beis Yosef we have a choice. We can either attribute to the Agur a position that may not make sense because Beis Yosef did and rejected him. Or we can say, no, the Beis Yosef is right. Nobody would ever hold that position.
No, but obviously the Beis Yosef understood that the Agur held.
And that's why he rejected him.
I agree, but then you have proof text or someone involved.
You have somebody who believes that somebody else was wrong and held this. Right? But they're just as likely to be wrong that somebody else held it. Right? It's a very dangerous thing, right? I attack somebody else, right? I construct somebody's position that way. Let's say, right, what Yesh claims I did with the Shirei Rav this time, right? I construct somebody's position, then I say it's wrong. So now you're going to say, but Rabbi Klapper understood the Shirei Rav as taking this position, so we can paskin like that. And Yesh will say, no, Rabbi Klapper misunderstood it. Rabbi Klapper is right that position is ridiculous. Well, right, that position is hard to sustain. There, right, so the better thing is to say, no, nobody, right, he misunderstood him in saying that. Right, it's exactly the same argument. Right, so what I'm saying is the Beis Yosef treats the Agur the same way I treated the Shirei Harav, and I'm going to counter-read the Agur the same way Yesh read the Shirei Harav, and I'm happy to do that. I think he's, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, the footnote is Beis Yosef b'shem Ogur. I don't think the Ramah quotes anything different. I don't think the Ramah's quote is at all different. Yeah, so it could be. You could say that you believe the Ramah read the Ogur the way that read against the Beis Yosef. Or you could say, as I suggested, the Ramah says, you know, whatever the truth was in the time of the Agur, it's been 200 years. And for 200 years, our community has had the practice of paskening like the Agur. So that's fine. But then the Beis Yosef... It doesn't matter what the grounds are. The Ramah can just say, in 1312, whatever it is, right, the Agur said that the halacha is that women can't shech. The minhag is that women can't shech. For 200 years... we have adopted the custom of the Agur. Now it's not; he doesn't have to paskin lo reinu at all. He can just say actively now, for the last 200 years, whenever anybody in Ashkenaz, whenever a woman in Ashkenaz wanted to shech, we said, no, you can't do that. That's the Agur. Now there's really a minhag. No, it's exactly the other case, right? Right. Once the Agur, what I'm saying is, once the Agur said it, the whole world changes. And that's so. I think you could read the Agur that way. You could read the Ramah saying it that way. And if you want to make the argument just off the Agur, I can't disprove it. But so far as I know, nobody ever has tried to make the argument just off the Agra. They always try to make it off the Shach and the Ma'arik. And the Shach and the Ma'arik I find very hard to sustain. At the same time, look, I have to say, with all honesty, the Shach really does say that hard part of it. And he says it even though he's aware that the Shilta Giborim, right, rejects it out of hand. And the Shach certainly read the second Shuvah of the Ma'arik. I confess I am deeply puzzled by the Shach's sticking to that position in light of the Shilta Giborim and in light of the Ma'arik. I find it very hard to believe that the Shach was not aware of the first Ma'arik. So you can just say at the end of the day, you can say what I'm doing is I am taking the position of various people like the Tumim against the Shach, and I'm paskening, you know, like Pashup Shat in the Ma'arik and the Beis Yosef. But you could say that somebody holds the narrower position and they're just passing like the Shach in Echinami. I can't tell. I don't deny the Shach says it. The Shach says it. Yes. So that's a fair question. And then the issue is, right, is it a, generally, I think, lalacha we hold that if people have a minag, but they have the minag on the basis of the mistaken impression that it's usur, so then you can be mevatel the minag if you choose to.
The way that Tosfot reads the Sugya Mitzachim is they make that distinction about whether or not people believe the minhag is halacha or not, so they know it's a minhag, or that the minhag was created by...
Right, so this is an interesting case where it might be that people mistakenly believe there's a minhag, and therefore they have the minhag. Right, so that's a wonderful circular case. All right, whether you can be mevatel a minhag on the grounds that people mistakenly believe there's a minhag.
I have a minhag that was established by rabbis who really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have... I say really in this shir, I'm really trying to make a very narrow point. Right? The really narrow point is that you can't use the Ma'arik to establish any of this. And since the Ma'arik is what everyone has used it to establish it, it's not strong. That's, you know, that's the really narrow point. How that plays out is a very I think that we all understand that in lots of areas, or so there's a gender and not, lots of things happen in modern Orthodoxy that didn't happen in the past. I think we all understand that. Then there are all sorts of issues about whether that's because even though those were minhagim, it takes gedolim to break minhagim in the past or things like that, or whether it just happens that there's no such principle. Right? So I'm suggesting that there's no such principle, which doesn't mean that, as I mentioned before in another case, that if you're a shul rav, you should have an inertial principle on the whole. Right? That if you have something that's going to cause controversy and it's never been done before, it's not that there's a minhag not to do it that way, it's just bad to cause controversy. But sometimes it's worth it, right? If there's a minhag in your shul that nobody's ever learned daf yomi because we're all lamdanim, right? Right, there was a Rosh Yeshiva here, Rabbi Weiss. My father used to love quoting him, where they came over to him and said, Dr. Clapper, the problem is, now nobody wants to learn anymore. My father said, what do you mean? Right, all these yeshivas, this is amazing. And he said, nobody wants to learn anymore. Look at all the daf yomi shurim. Right, so you could have that, say, our minhag is we don't do daf yomi, we only learn iyun. And then at some point somebody comes along and says, no, you know what, maybe iyun isn't working for everybody and we should have daf yomi shurim. And, right, you know, there are all sorts of things that the minhag could be not that way. I know once, many years ago in camp, I was learning Tanakh in the Beis Medrash. And people just looked at me like, what? Isn't it against the Therish Arashi? Right? You know, and I thought it wasn't such a terrible thing to learn Tanakh. Right? That, you know, there are lots of things about which you could say things like that. And I'm not in any way. Right? Again, I'm trying to be. Okay, I'll say, and I'm going to, because to some extent this shir takes place in the context, so it's worth addressing, you know, something of the straightforward issue. I think it's really, really very important on all communal issues to make sure that we are perfectly honest about the Torah. Whether we want something to happen or not something to happen, we have to be perfectly honest about the Torah. There are lots of changes that people want to make in the community that I oppose. There are some changes that people want to make in the community that I support. And there are lots of changes that people want to make in the community that I'm ambivalent about. I think there are good, in almost all of these cases, I think that reasonable people can make the argument both ways. But I think that it's really important to make sure that we keep the halachic argument perfectly honest. That has not always happened in the past. Unfortunately, specifically on issues of gender, it has often not happened in the past, where people have written things both Leheter and Leisher, that are not true to the text, and that they, I think, were often aware were not true to the text. So I want very much to distinguish between what I say in the context of a shir and what I say in the context of a policy statement. The purpose of the shir tonight is just to say that here is an argument which is often made in this context. I don't believe this argument emerges from the makorot, which the argument is usually made from, although I concede that at least on part of it, the Shach does seem to say it. I think the weight of the evidence is against the Shach. Right? That doesn't mean that therefore all changes are good, or all changes are mutter, or all changes are desirable. It just means that there is, that you can't make the argument. If I'm right, you say, well, it's never been done, therefore it can't be done. Because there's a minug to not make it done. Because Marik says so. That's not true. Right? That's the whole point I want to make. And we'll have an advertisement at the end again, right? So if you have a few... By now, you know, it's late at night, so you might want to just start filling out the application for the Summit of Midrash now, and you could finish it in the morning before, you know, go to Vasikin, I would suggest. And afterwards, so part of what I hope that you'll come and learn in that process is that it's possible to be utterly rigorous and honest about the halacha, and also to be utterly rigorous and utterly honest about the fact that you do want certain things to happen. And that those are not impossible positions to hold simultaneously, that I'm really going to read the text with perfect integrity, and yet I have a rooting interest. Right, you can do both of those together. Tonight's shir is only about reading the text with integrity. I'm not talking about what my rooting interest is at all. But if you sign up, you'll probably, for the Dvar Torah, which you'll have now, hopefully already, then you'll probably find out at some point what the rooting interest is.